You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Nadira. We are going to get started in just a second, but before we do, I just want to make sure that folks can hear me. So first off, Amity, it looks like you're logged in. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. Great. And it looks like we've also got a couple other folks who are logged in. If you wouldn't mind just saying hello quickly so I can tell that you can hear me too.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Excellent. All right. So it looks like we are all set. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to mute all of the callers to make sure that we have a nice clean line. So this will take me 1 second. Okay. And Amity, can you still hear me?
I can still hear you.
Okay, fantastic. So in that case, why don't we get started? So hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 27 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. This episode is being sponsored by Alia Sabat, who is offering a free webinar, How to Break Out of That Dance Rut, 7 Ways to Spark Inspiration, Refresh Creativity, and Awaken Joy for Real. You can check that out at aliasabat.com/dance-rut. So that's dance-rut. Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. It's really easy to get help with the what. So if you want to learn about moves or learn a choreography, you can't throw a stick without, you know, finding a good resource for that. But if you want help with the why and the how, so things like musicality, culture, professionalism, composition, that can be a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest today is Amity Elise. She's a dancer, studio owner, troupe director, event producer, and CPA licensed in New Hampshire. As a dancer, she understands the needs, demands, and management of running a dance business. And as a CPA, she specializes in small businesses and nonprofits to help them understand the bookkeeping, tax, payroll, and management requirements. Combining these two passions, she's created a variety of products and services to help dancers spend less time worrying about the time behind the scenes so they can focus on being on stage. You can check her out at rockon.net, which is RAQ-ON.net. So welcome, Amity.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
My pleasure. So today we're going to talk about tax considerations for dancers. But before we do that, why don't we have you tell us a little bit about yourself? So can you tell us about how you got started in belly dance?
Sure. I actually started taking dance classes, ironically, with Alia Sabat, when I was 14, and I've stuck with it since. I absolutely love it, and it's now become, you know, my other job, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Excellent. And tell us about your background in taxes.
Yes. I've been doing taxes for about 10 or 11 years now, and I started at a couple small firms that did tax and audit, and now I work for a $1 billion healthcare agency managing their tax system. And I also help out with a lot of small businesses and nonprofits in making sure that they understand what they need to do as well.
Excellent. So you really have this stuff from both sides of the desk.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Now, before we get going into the interview itself, are there any caveats that you'd like to tell people about what they're about to hear?
Sure, absolutely. Obviously, with any tax situation, it all depends on the type of structure that you have, what state you're in, where you're located, and where your business is located. So, you know, I'm going to talk a lot in general today, and a lot of it's going to be mainly based on sole proprietors or independent contractors, the small businesses, quote-unquote. But definitely check in. If you have any local resources, check in with your local CPA, check in with your local SCORE offices. They have a lot of resources, and a lot of them are for free. There's also the IRS.gov website. That's actually, they revised it a couple years ago, and it's much more user-friendly than it was in the past. But definitely check it out with your specific situation, because, you know, I'm going to try to talk as general as possible to help as many as possible, but your facts and circumstances might be slightly different.
Mm-hmm. So this is general information, not personal advice, as if they were your client.
Exactly.
Okay. And also, this is going to apply mostly for U.S. callers, is that right?
Yep, U.S. callers, or those individuals that come to the U.S., this would usually apply to you as well.
Okay, great. So let's jump in a little bit. So first off, who needs to report dance income on their taxes?
IRS taxes total worldwide income. So it doesn't depend, it doesn't really matter where the income came from. If you made money, the IRS wants to know. To put it in the most simple terms, if you're a hobbyist, you have a certain situation. If you're a professional, you have a different situation. But in general, the IRS wants to see total worldwide income. And then if you have exclusions, then you would just show those to offset the income.
Okay, and what if you've made money dancing but you didn't make a profit at dancing? Do you need to report that too?
It depends. If you, obviously, you want to report it, but there's two different ways that you can report income from performing. And it really depends on the individual as to whether or not you're doing it as a hobby or if you're actually trying to make a profit. Because there's a lot of dancers, you know, when you first get started, same with artists, that the first couple of years, most likely you're not going to make a profit because you have to add the value to your name. And so there's two main sections. There's those who have hobby income and then there's who have business income. And there's a big difference from a tax standpoint and how it's treated. For example, if you have business income, you pay taxes on that income, but you can offset it with your expenses. Some years you may make income, some years you may lose income, or lose through expenses. And that situation, you'd file it through the normal business taxes. However, if you're a hobbyist, you're not allowed a loss. You take it on your personal tax return on a different section, and you can only deduct the expenses to the amount of income that you have. It's easier. Especially for those people who maybe perform a couple times a year or if they really don't have a profit motive. It's easier to report as hobby income. However, you can't report hobby losses. Whereas a business, you have business income and then you can have business losses. And there's a 9-factor smell test for whether or not you have a hobby versus a business. And so I'll just cover those in a little bit just so people can start getting those wheels spinning on whether or not you fit into whichever category. The first thing first in the smell test is books and records like a business. If you have no books and records, you probably don't have a bona fide business, or you might want to consider having official books and records. Books and records include having receipts, having bookkeeping done, showing your profit, showing your losses, maybe even having a separate checking account. The second one is expertise. Are you seen as somebody in the dance world is having expertise to become a professional dancer or to have a teaching program or to be a professional performer? If you have those, you're probably in the business line. If you're just doing it on the side maybe two times a year because, you know, dancing in a restaurant is fun and you make $25, you still may have the expertise, but you're not really going out there and putting your name out there nationally, I guess is an example. The other one is time and effort. If you're working on your business 40 hours a week, that's going to show more like an actual taxable entity versus a couple hours a month. There's also the expectation of appreciation, which is, expectation of eventually making a profit. If you have no profit motive, then, it's hard to justify whether or not you actually have a business that can take those losses. But again, as performing artists, and there was actually just a court case not too long ago, I believe it was in New York, where an artist was losing money for, I think, the first 10 years, and the IRS audited them and said, you don't have a profit motive because you're losing money. And she actually won in the sense that she was showing that she was making her name. She had to make all this artwork. She had to spend the time in order to get more well-known before her artwork became valuable. The other thing is financial status and other income resources. You might be like me, for example. I have my day job, and I also have my night job. And so if this is not your main source of income, sometimes it's harder to prove to the IRS that you're actually in a business. Not saying it's impossible, I'm not saying it's not that difficult to prove, but it's all about documentation and bookkeeping. And then the last one, which I always find is an oxymoron, especially for performing artists, is pleasure and recreation out of the activity. That's actually listed on the hobby income. I don't know about you guys, but if I didn't like dance, I would not be doing this as a business. So it's kind of one that a lot of people who have a performing arts background or are artists, they kind of giggle at that one because it's like, why would we do it if we didn't love it?
Mm-hmm.
The other one is that usually there's this old, I don't want to call it a wives' tale, it's just kind of an outdated system was that, oh, if you lose money 3 years out of five, the IRS is going to audit you, so don't take those expenses. It's a guideline, but realize that the IRS can audit you at any time. But if you are a dancer and say you're a performing artist and you're taking a whole bunch of expenses because you bought a whole bunch of costumes that year, that's easy to justify to the IRS. They may question you, but don't be afraid of them. The other issue is that if, say, you're a dance teacher and then you buy a whole bunch of costumes, the IRS is really going to say, well, maybe the performing is the hobby side and the teaching is the business side, and therefore exclude the costumes if it's exuberant. So those are kind of a couple of examples on the hobby income versus business income.
Now, when it comes to how much tax you pay, is there a difference when you're a hobby versus a business? Like what rate you're taxed at?
You actually put it in as other income on your tax return, and the expenses have to be itemized. So if you file Schedule A, which is the itemized deduction, same as where you put your mortgage interest and your property taxes. So if you're one of those people that fall in the bucket that you can't itemize, you could be paying straight out on the income and not being able to deduct the expenses.
Okay, so if you don't itemize your expenses, so if you take, I think, what's called the standard deduction, then
yep.
You can't deduct any of your hobby expenses, but you could deduct business expenses because that's somewhere else?
Correct.
Gotcha. Are there any other differences that we need to know about when we decide whether we want to pursue this as a hobby or a business?
I would say follow the smell test, and how does it feel to you? A lot of it's a judgment call. A lot of it, there's no black and white line as to which one, but if you feel like you can actually justify that you have a business, do it as a business. Even if you make $1,000 a year, just make sure that your expenses are reasonable. The IRS uses a word a lot for expenses that's called ordinary and necessary. So if the expenses are ordinary and necessary to your business, that's when you'd want to take them. Again, sometimes a lot of people have a hard time because this is also their hobby and their passion. So just looking at your expenses at the end of the year and saying, what is actually ordinary and necessary for me to have that business? It's all about reasonability.
Excellent. Now, when it comes to reporting dance income, you know, how do we go about it? What forms do we use? What kinds of things do we need to do?
It all depends on the structure that you choose. And we'll talk mainly about sole proprietors, but just as an overview of different types of entities, you can be a sole proprietor, also known as an independent contractor. It's the simplest form. You're responsible for the business. If, from a legal perspective, if somebody gets hurt, they sue you, they could come after your assets. The second option is a partnership. And this is usually when you have more than one person in the business itself. And with partnerships, they're a separate entity away from the partners involved. And that one files a different form. It's Form 1065. And those are taxed at the individual level, but it's almost like you kind of get like a W-2 from the partnership, except it's called a K-1. It reports all the income and expenses.
Mm-hmm.
The third option is corporations. And corporations I rarely ever see in the performing arts world unless somebody's incorporating to become a nonprofit. And these ones, avoid them like the plague unless you know exactly what you're doing or if you're looking for investors, because you have the potential for double taxation.
And what does that mean?
Double taxation. You get taxed at the corporate level on the income, and then the individual gets taxed on their share of any distributions from the corporation.
Okay.
You pay taxes twice. So, like I said, and most people don't do corporations unless they have a specific purpose, such as investors, or if they have they want something a little bit more rigid about legal and liability issues.
And did you mention an LLC yet?
LLCs can take one of either as a sole proprietor, or they can also be a partnership in some states. As most people, if they're going to become a sole proprietor, most lawyers say that a single member LLC is the way to go because it gives you a little bit more liability coverage.
And can you explain how that works?
What's that?
Can you explain how that works for people who don't know what an LLC is?
Yep. An LLC is a limited liability company. So it's saying it looks and smells separate from the individual, even though there's only one member or one owner. Like, for example, my studio is an LLC, so it's Rock On Dance LLC, but I'm the only owner. Kind of gives you a separate shield. However, that shield is only as good as your books. I see a lot of people set up LLCs and then they use their personal checking account. If in the corporate world, it's called piercing the corporate veil. So if you use corporate money for personal purposes, from a legal standpoint, and obviously I'm not a lawyer, but in general, if you use that money in your personal life from your business without having that shield of showing the books going to and for, then your shield of coverage from a legal perspective is gone. So if I have my LLC,
like, profit out of your LLC, you have to, like, write yourself a check.
You have to write,
like,
yourself
my profit.
Exactly. Write yourself a check and make sure you're covered and that the books are clean, that they're separate. Because otherwise, if you just mingle it into your personal checking account, then more than likely you're at a higher risk if somebody was to ever sue you.
Okay, and so if somebody does sue the LLC, then only the money and assets that the LLC has are at risk. So they couldn't, say, get your house as long as your books are clean and your LLC is good.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on the situation. I've seen people still come after homes and houses, but it gives you a little bit higher level of risk coverage.
Okay.
And the LLCs, the single-member LLCs, file the same form as a sole proprietor independent contractor, so you don't have to change any of your bookkeeping. It's usually just a form that a lawyer has to file for you, and you usually have an LLC agreement that you have to send to the state.
Gotcha.
So out of all of them, sole proprietors and single-member LLCs are the easiest to manage.
Okay, and a sole proprietor is just one person doing business, so not necessarily any fancy legal paperwork.
Exactly. So you still have to file with the state if you use a different name.
Gotcha. So, for example, you know, my name is Jessica Reed, but I do business as Nadira Jamal. So I could do business as Jessica Reed and not have to file any paperwork, but to accept checks as Nadira Jamal, et cetera, I had to file stuff at my city hall.
Exactly. Yep.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. So let's move on to deductions and expenses, which I think are the part that most people are interested in. So, you know, what kinds of expenses are deductible for dancers and teachers, or what kinds of things are not?
It goes back to the ordinary necessary business expenses again. I get a lot of questions from people, from dancers. They're like, oh, well, can I deduct my makeup? Can I deduct my manicures? Can I deduct my costumes? When it comes to reporting your income, obviously the income one's easier because most people know what they've made. The expenses, you can take a whole section of it. And the easiest way that I always tell people to set up their bookkeeping, instead of sitting there and saying, okay, how many buckets do I need? Pull out the actual tax form that you're going to file and use the same exact bucket. You can keep your bookkeeping as simple as creating folders by those categories.
Hmm.
Or you could set up a QuickBooks file. You could set up a couple online accounting options. You can even just, you know, use a shoebox, but I didn't tell you that. Accountants don't like shoeboxes. We get them all the time.
They're beautifully filed inside that shoebox.
Exactly. Beautifully filed in folders by category. It'll save you a ton of money when it comes to tax prep fees. So the expense buckets really depend on the type of entity that you're going to file for. They're similar, but they could be a little bit different. So if you are a sole proprietor, an independent contractor, go on irs.gov, irs.gov, go under Forms and Publications, and then type in Schedule C for Form 1040. It's going to pop up with a form called the Profit or Loss from Business. And underneath it's going to say sole proprietorship. You'll see 2014 at the top of the form to make sure you have the most recent one. And again, that's Schedule C. And you can literally see the buckets that the IRS wants you to use. And honestly, that's the easiest way. Unless you're going to do, if you have a loan, if you have anything reporting that you have to report to anybody else, such as a bank, most people just keep their expenses by these buckets. So for an example, the first one is advertising. Any expenses that you use for promoting your classes, promoting yourself as a dancer, it would all go in the advertising bucket. Car and truck expenses, commission and fees, you know, if you use any managers. Contracted labor, you are a business, and you're paying somebody for services such as dance classes, private lessons, coming and teaching classes at your studio. That's where that would go, is under contracted labor. And there's also something called depreciation, which we can get into more detail later. insurance, if you pay for performing insurance, liability insurance, if you have any loans, bills, if you pay a lawyer to set up your beautiful LLC, you can also take that. Office expenses, if you have to rent or lease space to teach or to perform, repairs and maintenance, supplies, even, you know, pens, pencils, paper, sequins and rhinestones, they all can go under there. Taxes and licenses, if you have to pay the state or if you have to have a performing license, some of the states actually require that. And travels, meals, and entertainment, which is a hot one for performing artists. With travels, meals, and entertainment, again, it's reasonability. If you go out to a gig and you buy your food, most of the time it's probably not actually something that you would normally deduct for your business, because as an individual going to work on a day-to-day basis, your employer doesn't give you a food stipend. So you wouldn't normally have a food expense that you could take on as an employee. If you pay people, and then there's the other expenses. And other expenses could be anything from costuming. If you go out and get your nails done all the time, some CPAs, we all don't agree on the way that upkeep for hair, nails, and costuming and makeup are deducted. So keep that in mind. But my feeling, personal feeling is using reasonability. For example, makeup. If you go out and you buy a set of makeup that you use for personal and for performing, I would probably take it based on the percentage of use. So if you buy a $10 bottle of foundation and you use it 20% of the time for performing, I would take $2 instead of the $10. Just for reasonability.
Separate makeup kit. So it's some duplicate items just so that I know this is all my stage makeup.
Exactly, yep. And sometimes stage makeup's different, so you have to buy a completely separate kit. So, yeah, you can either go the separate kit route or you can take a percentage. And same with manicures. Same with upkeep. Haircuts, unless it's something specific like you've been an updo, just be wary that it could get questioned. But, you know, if you're a performing artist and you have to dye your hair because the restaurant requires you to have black hair, for example, and that would be something that you could probably justify. But in those areas, it's reasonability. That's a big one. And costuming, again, we all probably have a little bit of a costume addiction. And it's just using good faith effort and reasonability in what you deduct as a business expense. But also, if you take the costume as an expense, make sure you take the income of selling that costume in. Report that on your tax return as well.
Exactly. So if you're deducting $600 for buying it and you sell it for $400, then you have to claim the income selling it.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, you know, one rule of thumb that, you know, I heard once about all these kind of gray area things like your hair and your nails is, if you weren't a dancer, is this something that you might still do? Like, if you were an employee but not a performer, is this something that you would do? And if so, it's more dangerous to deduct those things. Do you think that's accurate?
Absolutely. Totally agree. And the same thing with classwear. A lot of people are like, oh, I deduct my yoga pants. There's actually a uniform rule with the IRS that if you're in business for yourself and you buy clothing for your employees, you have to look at it as to whether it's something that they can wear on the street. If it's something that they can wear on the street and it's not a specialty item, most of the time it's not really a deductible expense. However, if it's like steel-toed shoes or if it's a specific uniform because it's a specific color, that would be a deductible expense. However, you could also fit some of that classwear in an advertising expense. If you get logo shirts and logo pants and logo hip scarves, for example, those items could be considered advertising expenses and not just quote-unquote day-to-day wear.
That's really smart.
Keep that in mind.
Okay. Now, if you don't know whether an expense is a deductible, how can you confirm that? How can you get more advice or more information on that?
You can actually go on the IRS website, and they go through a couple scenarios. There's also a couple websites for performing artists, and I can't remember them off the top of my head at the moment, but I'll post them in the clubhouse. They have some good examples in there. Essentially, like I said, if it's reasonable and necessary and it's an ordinary expense in the course of your business that you need in order to do your duties, it's probably safe to take.
One thing I can add to that is the IRS actually has a business line. So if you are running a business and you want to ask about that, you can call them. I called them once in March, which was pretty close. Not super close to the deadline, but well into tax season, and I waited on hold for 90 minutes before I got somebody. But once I finally did, they were really nice and really helpful. And I just like went to my list, and they said, yes, 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 no, yes, no. And it was super helpful. And I also assume that, you know, talking to an accountant can help.
Yep, talking to an accountant, talking to a CPA, a lot of Chamber of Commerce's have resources or lunch and learns or breakfast meets and greets that are very helpful that they have topics. I'm a big fan of the Small Business Administration. They have a website, sba.gov. Or also SCORE, which is usually an assembly of retired individuals that are willing to help small businesses. You can also go to your local colleges and see if they have a business incubator. A lot of them have what's called the incubator for small businesses, where a lot of entrepreneurs go for resources and help.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple of like specific items that I've run into where I haven't been quite sure if I really should deduct these. So things like show tickets, if I go to see a show to support somebody or to be seen or, you know, to do research and see what's going on that I can, you know, steal from my own dancing. Mm-hmm. And those seem like semi-clear, but there are also times when, say, you know, I go out to dinner at a venue that doesn't have a cover charge, and so my expense is my dinner. But at the same time, this is a dinner in my local town, and that's something that I might do for recreation, even though I'm there on behalf of my business. Mm-hmm. Are there any guidelines around that?
If you could fit it into like a research, like I'm looking into, you know, the specific dances of, I don't know, the New England dancers of the folkloric dances of New England, and you're going to a show to do that research, and then you're going to teach it or perform it, and you know that eventually that will happen, that would be something that you could probably deduct. If it's something to go and support a friend of a dancer, you're kind of in that area that I would personally not take it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to an event because it's going to give you good exposure, you can. Like, for example, our studio, we do a lot of community events where it's more of a fundraiser, and we perform for free. But what I do is I take the mileage back and forth as marketing expense and make sure I have flyers and business cards with me. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, that's handy. You know, now another kind of big area that people are unsure about is travel expenses. So let's say you're going to a festival to study or teach, you know, and you know, not, you don't always get paid for your travel expenses at the bigger ones. So, you know, are there any guidelines around that?
It's definitely keep a record of mileage. Just keep a notebook in your car. You can actually print off free mileage record books right off the IRS website. Make sure it's documented and the purpose. And then you can just simply just total it all up at the end of the year. But, yeah, if you go and teach and perform anywhere, you can, and it's not your ordinary place where you go on a day-to-day basis, you can definitely take the mileage and travel expenses. Just as if you're an employee of any business that you go to work on, like, say, if you had a 40-hour weekday job, you can't take that mileage expense on your taxes of getting to work. But if you go somewhere special after you get to that place of work to a second location, that's when you can start taking the expenses. So the same exact thing. If you go to the same place every day and that's your normal place of business, it's a little bit grayer to take that mileage expense. I've seen it questioned a lot. But if you go and you travel to an event or workshop, definitely take the mileage expense.
That from one place of business to another one is actually kind of a subtle point, but I use it all the time because one of my classes is right after my day job on Mondays. And so if the bus is late, sometimes I have to take a taxi to get there on time. And because I'm going from my day job location to my dance job location, that falls into that one place of business to another. But if I'm running late coming from home to my studio and I have to take a taxi to get there, I don't drive, by the way, which is why I'm taking a cab, then I don't claim that.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, one question that we had that a listener posted beforehand is, you know, what happens if you stay with friends while you're traveling on a dance business trip? Is there any way to account for that, or is that just free?
It's an interesting conversation to have for sure, but usually you could probably just take the mileage to and from that friend because you're not incurring any expense, any cash outflow. It's less likely that the IRS would ever consider you taking any expense for staying with a friend. They're looking at it as physical cash outflow. If you paid the friend to stay there and they gave you a receipt, you could probably deduct it. But then again, then you're making your friend have taxable income. Which means that they're no longer your friend.
Gotcha.
So I would avoid that personally. But if it's a place that you have to go and say you stay at a hostel and there's a nightly fee, then that's different.
Now, when we're thinking about all these expenses and keeping records and then, you know, it's tax time and we're filling out our forms, how important is it to put your expenses in the right category on that form? Because I know for a lot of things, it's not clear, is this advertising or is it other?
Use your best judgment. Good faith effort is very important in the IRS's eyes, and consistency. So if you consistently use the same expense buckets for the same items year after year, they're less likely to question it. I would say give it your best shot, good faith effort. And I mean, if they ever audit you and say your travel expenses were in the advertising bucket, well, you know, your tax rate's not really going to change.
Because it all gets deducted as a single total.
Exactly.
All right. Now,
There's also the other expense line down at the bottom that's kind of like that miscellaneous. If you don't know where something goes, you can always use the other expense line.
Okay. Now, a little while ago when we were talking about these buckets, you mentioned depreciation. Can you tell us what that is and when you need to use it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So in the tax world, we have our own realm of things that make sense that sometimes don't make sense to the every day and ever period, actually.
That's so true.
And actually, when you said calling the IRS, 90 minutes is actually pretty short these days. So depreciation. You have something that's called a period cost, and you have something called a depreciable asset. Period costs are those items that you buy for your business that usually have a useful life of less than a year and are generally low dollar values. Those are the items that you would expense in the same year that you purchased it. For example, if you buy advertising, generally that's less than a year useful life. Or if you buy office supplies, you take it in the same year. However, let's say you bought a sound system, a lighting, or computers. It's kind of those equipment and asset items is when you would depreciate. Because the IRS is thinking, and it's actually a benefit to you, in the sense that say you buy a $500 laptop. If you take that $500 expense all in one year, you no longer have an expense for future years, even though you're going to be using that item to generate income in the future years. So what we would do with a $500 laptop is we'd actually depreciate it over 3 years. The IRS has defined how long assets usually survive for. So for example, the laptop, usually 3 years is its useful life. So instead of taking the $500 expense laptop in 1 year, you'd actually divide it over 3 years, so you'd have $167 a year tax expense instead of taking it all in one. There are options.
First time I had to do that, I was so cranky because I had spent $1,000 on a lighting equipment and the money went out in that year, but I didn't get the benefit of claiming the deduction except in the same period.
There is something called Section 179 depreciation. And every year Congress extends it, which is nice of them, but every year they're like, well, we don't know if it's going to be here next year. And the Section 179 expense allows you to take a lot of these small assets with low dollar values and actually depreciate it in 1 year instead of three.
And can you tell us the name of that again one more time? It was
Section 179.
Section 179. Thank you.
We don't like using normal terms and definitions that make sense. We just like code numbers.
Well, at least it's precise. If you look that up, you're gonna get the right information.
Yep. So Section 179.
Okay. So other than actually looking it up, are there any guidelines about what kinds of things need to be depreciated? Like, is there a specific dollar value or a specific type of equipment?
It's pretty much everything that a dancer or performing artist would buy except the physical building. It's usually the low dollar items. I can't remember the dollar threshold, but I want to say it was close to around $100,000, or it could even be more. So if you buy a sound system or lighting or computers or anything that has a useful life greater than a year, you probably could take the 179 deduction.
Okay, great. Now, when we're talking about, you know, our income and our expenses, what kinds of records do we have to keep, and how long do we have to keep them?
Oh, this is my favorite topic. I write a lot of record retention policies for organizations. It's one of my favorite nerdy things to do. How long should you keep your records for? First of all, make sure you have records. People laugh when I say that, but definitely make sure that you have records, whichever way you want to keep them, whether it's electronic, through a shoebox but with folders inside, or you go to Staples and get one of those nice portable file cabinets. Keep records and keep them clean. Don't wait until the end of the year to have your mental breakdown to get all your tax stuff together. I've seen it many, many times.
And it still feels like that every year.
Exactly.
But not a bad first year, but it was a mess.
What I always suggest to everybody who has a small business, if you don't already, go out and get a separate checking account. Have a separate checkbook. Only use it for business items. So if you have income, deposit into that account. If you have expenses, pay it out of that account. If you're going to pay yourself, write a check out of it to your personal account. If you're going to contribute money into the business, write a check to the business from your personal account. Keep everything separate because it makes it a lot easier. And what's really cool is that a lot of the banks now, if you go online and use the online banking, you can actually set up categories. So if you pay the same thing often, it'll automatically categorize it for you at the end of the year. QuickBooks Online is like that now, too. You can link your bank account so that when you reconcile your bank account on every month, then you can see the ins and outs, and it'll categorize it for you. There's also Mint.com. It wouldn't be something that you would normally use in a big business, but if you're a small-town dancer and you have a couple thousand dollars of income a year, Mint.com is free, and it allows you to classify and make up your own buckets. So a lot of people like that. But definitely keep records of all your expenses, keep all receipts, keep your check stubs, keep a travel and mileage log, keep copies of all checks that you receive. So when you do a deposit into that bank account, you would just photocopy the checks that you received and then keep that and deposit the income. So that way you always have it. The IRS, you have to substantiate all the income and the expenses you claim on your return. If you file your tax returns correctly, the IRS can go back to 3 years. If they've determined that there are errors, fraud, or you didn't file at all, they can go back much longer. Most CPAs will suggest that you keep your records in your tax returns for 7 years. And
now, you know, if you had an expense and you lost the receipt, is there any way that you can still deduct it? Like, I know a lot of people say, well, it's on my credit card statement. Isn't that good enough?
You can. It's a little bit riskier, but I've seen it go through perfectly fine.
Okay, so it may or may not be allowed.
Yeah. There's two publications that I highly recommend to everybody to read. You know, it's great bedtime reading, or if you get really, really excited about, you know, IRS instructions, they're actually not too bad to read. I'm just trying to give you some more resources. On the IRS.gov website, there's two publications. There's one called Publication 583. It's a publication specifically for starting a business and keeping records. Read that first before you go out and spend a whole bunch of money on lawyers and CPAs, because they tend to add up very quickly in how quickly expenses can be when starting up a business. That will have all of the 101 basics. Read that first, and then go and have your open questions ready. So that was publication 583. The other publication that's very helpful, especially for those travel expenses, is publication 463. And that's specifically for travel and business expenses. So if you need more examples of mileage, when you can deduct mileage, when you can add mileage, meals and entertainment expenses, that's the publication you'd want to go to.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to keep records and keeping your books, are there particular tools that you'd recommend? You already mentioned Mint.
Yep. Mint's very, again, very simple. I use it for my personal stuff, and I love it because I can see all my stuff in a snapshot. The most basic, if you're not tech savvy, would be going out and grabbing files, manila folders, and making one for each month of the year. At the end of each month, put all your revenue, put all your expenses in there, and create a little summary page on the top of the envelope so that you have your buckets ready each month. And then at the end of the year, you just have to total up those 12 months, and it's so much easier.
So you could like write that right on the folder itself.
Exactly.
Cool.
You can also do it in an Excel file. QuickBooks, I'm a big fan of QuickBooks because once you set up QuickBooks, it just kind of runs itself. It is a little bit more expensive. The online version, you can buy a cloud-based version, but the problem is there's a monthly fee. The good thing with that is that almost every CPA and every accountant, every tax accountant, anybody you go to knows how to use QuickBooks. So you can actually just transfer the files to them, and then they can use that for their purpose, and you don't have to do a lot of manual manipulation. There's also a lot of online versions that are coming out with different bookkeeping, but honestly, I haven't used a lot of them. QuickBooks is kind of the go-to methodology. If you have if you're a dance teacher, I actually just started using Mindbody. And I didn't realize that they
online booking service, right?
Online booking service. You can book your classes, your private lessons, anything. You can sell stuff through an online store. They actually have a pretty good bookkeeping behind the scenes, which I was very skeptical. But they actually, you can do the tax reporting right out of that as well.
Hmm. Interesting. I'd like to add one recommendation to that. So you mentioned QuickBooks. I do use QuickBooks Online. I've been using it for about 5 years. And, you know, one thing that I ran into is, you know, I'm pretty savvy with numbers, but I wasn't super familiar with accounting. And
mm-hmm.
So for me, getting set up took a little bit of a learning curve. So once I got used to it, I find it really easy to use. But one thing that I literally discovered last week while I was looking for something else is that lynda.com has really good getting started training for both the online version and some of the desktop versions of QuickBooks too. So if people want to go electronic, that might be a good resource for getting started.
Yeah. The other cool thing with QuickBooks is that the way that QuickBooks kind of runs their business and kind of adds value and income to their pocketbooks too is that there's QuickBooks Pros everywhere. So you can actually have somebody physically come to your house and sit down with you and set up your QuickBooks file for you so that once it's done right. Because there's nothing worse than having a QuickBooks file set up and not realizing it's not specified to your business needs, because they have a lot of generic buckets. But sometimes it's nice to have somebody physically there and sit down with you and set it up the right way, and then you can kind of go on your own. And with QuickBooks, there's a QuickBooks Pros Advisors website, and you can look up whoever is a pro advisor anywhere in the country, and then they can come to your house, and you can also usually use them to bounce off questions at if you ever have any. So it's worth the money to kind of spend the money up front to have somebody help you if you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a great idea.
Yeah, and a lot of Chamber of Commerce have resources for QuickBooks and training programs. Every state CPA society has QuickBooks programs, training. But, you know, you don't have to go electronic. Sometimes a lot of people are like, oh, I need an electronic system, I need to do this, and I need to do this. And then they realize that their business needs are so small that it's actually more time-consuming and more frustrating than it is to do it on paper.
What I like about electronic and especially about the online version is that I can do it from anywhere. So if I taught classes on Sundays, I can, you know, log all my receipts when I get home. If I'm teaching on Monday night, I might do everything on Tuesday morning, you know, while I'm eating my lunch at my day job. And so that flexibility is nice. But, yeah, I mean, the tech stuff does take an extra piece of learning curve. So it's good to know that the straight-up paper option is viable.
Yeah, sometimes I wish that they needed like an MBA for performing artists, because you not only do you have to be good at a technical skill of like dance or being a visual artist or a musician, you also have to be the marketer, the accountant, the tax person, the DJ, the tech person, the lighting guy. You know what I mean? It's just funny how many hats performing artists have to wear, and you know this is just one small chip of what you do on a day-to-day basis. So that being said, keep it simple.
Absolutely. Now, you know, an awful lot of this really comes into play in the event that you get audited. And I know this is like this terrifying idea for a lot of people. And you know, one thing that comes up a lot is, you know, this idea of an audit trigger. Do they really exist?
You know, audits really aren't that scary. It could be because I deal with them. Like, I get to hang out with auditors next week, actually. most auditors are pretty relaxed individuals, and, you know, they're there to do their job, but a lot of them will see both sides of the story. The biggest thing is that, obviously, if you're a dancer and you have a $10,000 loss year after year, that's a red flag. If you have a lot of travel and meals expenses, and you have income, and that's your only expense, sometimes that can be a trigger. But constantly having losses or having one line of expenses that just is asked of like a, it's kind of asking for an audit if you have kind of outlandish expenses. That's the biggest trigger that I've seen. The home office deduction, a lot of dancers try to take I use this space for my business. I've seen a lot of them get excluded under audit, and this is just businesses in general, not just dancers, because the IRS will be like, okay, show me the space, and they realize it's their living room counter. Or it's multi-purpose room. The home office deduction has to be exclusively used for businesses. And so if you have a studio that you have in your house that you use to practice because you don't want to pay fees for renting a studio space, that's great, but just make sure it's used exclusively for that business and that you see clients there.
I have one, but I also have my elliptical in there because it's the most open space in the house, and I can't deduct it for that reason. I mean, we also keep a couple things in there that are my husband's that we wouldn't keep in there if I was claiming this space as business only, but like just the fact that we don't want the elliptical in the living room rules that right out.
I actually had a client a couple years ago actually put in a second entrance so that they could have a sign on the door and that clients could come in specifically through that door so that they didn't have to come through their living room and through the house, and that actually made it more justifiable that it actually is used for business purposes only.
Interesting. Now, you know, if an audit does happen, you know, you said it's not as scary as everybody thinks, so how does that usually go? What does it look like?
It takes forever. The IRS is probably, I feel bad for a lot of IRS agents because they're trying to do their job, but they don't have the funding and they don't have the technical resources to do things in the most efficient manner. Most IRS audits, what will happen is that they'll send you a letter saying, you know, we question these items. They'll give you a certain time frame to respond. And most of the time, if you send in enough detail in the letter with backup, with any questions that they have, that's probably the last time you hear about from any of the agents. And I'd say that's probably 75% of the time.
What's this $5,000 travel expense? Well, I went to Egypt and I studied with this person and this person and this person, and I taught this skill to my students and I performed this at this paying gig.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. I had this huge expense going to Egypt in this year, but next year you'll see this huge jump in income because the information that I learned from there I'm going to use in the future. So it's justifying your stance for taking those expenses. And then if they're not happy, they'll probably schedule an audit, and that could probably be a half day. A lot of people usually send them not to your house or where you go. Usually you have a lawyer or a CPA, and they go directly to their office, and then you provide all the backup information. Excuse me. And most audits take a year to 3 years to close, and it's mainly because it's sitting on somebody's desk and it's buried behind five other audits. So there's a lot of anticipation and agony waiting on the IRS to respond. But once they do respond, most of the time it's closed pretty quick.
And, you know, assuming that you've, you know, done your best and made an honest effort, what's the worst that can happen?
A good faith effort is good. The most common thing is they say, well, we don't agree with that expense. You can't take it, and you pay the difference in tax. And sometimes they tack on interest and penalties. If they think that you fraudulently filed the return and they found proof of that, there are much worse penalties to worry about.
That's getting into like the whole tax fraud area as opposed to you thought you could deduct this and it turned out you couldn't.
Right. Or if you're running a different type of business through your dance business, then that could also be an issue too. you know, there would even have to jail time for it for committing fraud.
Okay. But that's actual fraud. If they, you know, you thought it was deductible and it wasn't, then you just have to pay the taxes and probably a penalty and interest.
Taxes, penalty, and interest, yep.
And do you have a sense of what those penalties tend to be? Like, are we talking like $50, $100, $1,000?
It depends on your tax bracket. There's usually a penalty rate of how much per day, X amount per day, depending on the form. And then there's also the interest rate of the time from when you filed your tax return to when they actually found the issue. And then there's the tax rate in itself depends on the individual tax rate, which, you know, is usually between 15 to 35%, sometimes 40.
Okay. So, you know, moving on to some... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it can add up quickly.
So do your best, do your best, do your best.
Ordinary,
all right.
Necessary, and reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, moving on to some of these kind of less obvious considerations when we talk about taxes, you know, we're usually thinking expenses and income. But another big thing is sales tax. So under what circumstances do you have to collect sales tax?
Oh, this one's one of my favorite ones, too. So the challenge with dancers and dancers that travel from state to state is that all 50 states have different tax codes for sales tax purposes. So if you're a performing artist and you bring your DVDs and your CDs with you wherever you perform or you teach and you sell them in those states, most likely you probably owe sales tax in those states. Some states will give you an exclusion. Like if you're in the state for 10 days, you don't have to pay sales tax because it's not an ongoing business there. There's this thing called Nexus, and Nexus determines whether or not you owe taxes in that specific state, and it's based on the X number of days that you are there during the year. For example, if you live in California and you mainly do most of your business there, your business nexus would be California, and that's where you'd pay the sales tax. However, if you are in California and Nevada and you split your time half and half, you may owe sales tax to two different states. The cool thing is that most states for services don't charge sales tax, and a lot of costuming items in a lot of states are excluded from sales tax. But if you sell other items like CDs and DVDs, or even electronic items, if you write an ebook and you sell it, that could be subject to taxes. So the best thing you can do with those is literally call your Department of Revenue or the Secretary of State. Almost all of them are really, really great to work with, and they're used to having these questions all the time thrown at them, and they usually can send you to the form that you need to file and complete. Some states require sales tax to be paid on a quarterly basis, some on a biweekly basis, some on a monthly basis. It's all over the block. So as a CPA and somebody who has to be compliant, it can be a challenge. But again, do your best, do your due diligence, and most of the stuff that we do could be excluded, except those physical items that you saw.
Now, are there also sometimes when you might have to file tax forms to other people?
Absolutely. If you pay somebody else for services for your business, most of the time you're going to have to fill out a 1099 miscellaneous form for them. And this is actually becoming more and more important, especially if you hire foreign dancers or anybody who's not from the United States. If they come here and they perform services for your business, there are some very, very large and stringent penalties for not completing those forms, but it actually is a completely separate form from the 1099. So let me take a step back. If you pay anybody to perform services for your business, if you hire a teacher to come in and teach a workshop, if you hire somebody to clean, if you hire someone to do your taxes, if you pay them more than $600 a year and they're not a corporation and they're not a nonprofit, make sure you give them a 1099 miscellaneous at the end of the year. And then people have a panic attack moment going, oh my gosh, what's this form look like? It's pretty simple. And the secret to being able to fill it out at the end of the year without panicking is before you have anybody come in before you give them a check, before you sign the contract, make sure they give you a form W-9. And the form W-9 has their name, address, social security number, or employer identification number on it. And they sign at the bottom that they're a U.S. resident. At the end of the year, you total up everything that you've paid them. So say it comes over $600, say it's $650. You would take that W-9 out, fill out the same exact information on that 1099, and just put in the dollar amount. And then you mail it, and you're done. A lot of people don't get the W-9 until after they've paid people, and the chances of actually getting the W-9 dwindles significantly.
Well, especially because you need their social security number to do it.
Exactly. And a lot of people are like, what do you mean? I don't need to, you know, there's even me, and I've hosted over 100 dancers in the past 10 years. I've had people say, well, I'm not coming because I don't want to give you my tax information. But the liability is on you as the business owner to make sure that you are compliant. Once you fill out all your 1099 miscellaneouses, you have to keep a copy for yourself. You send a copy to them, and then you fill out one summary page on it, which is called the 1096, and send it to the IRS.
Now, my understanding is that if you've paid somebody with a credit card or through a payment processor like PayPal, then it's the processor's responsibility to send that.
Nope. If you pay them through PayPal, PayPal's not going to be the one that does the 1099 processing for you because they're just an intermediary. They're like a bank.
And I also read that this applies to things like studio rent.
It does. Rent is a line on the 1099s that if you pay studio rent, make sure you give, or if you have a physical location, make sure you give your landlord the 1099 at the end of the year. And that also justifies you as a business. So going back to the hobby income versus business income, if you're filing tax forms for other people, it's another step to show you that you're actually operating like a bona fide business.
Now, you know, getting into this filing tax forms for other people, one situation when you might have to do that is if you have, an assistant. But when we're getting into assistants, you know, how can you tell whether you need to treat them as a freelancer versus as an employee for their taxes?
The IRS and the Department of Labor have really, really cracked down on this area in the past couple of years, and they do a lot of independent contractor audits now, and there's a multi-step test. But essentially, an independent contractor, they come in and you say, I want this done, and they do it in the way that they do best, and they also have multiple clients. If you have somebody helping you and you can direct how they're doing it, when they do it, manage their schedule, manage their time frame, most likely they're an employee. An example of an independent contractor.
It doesn't matter how much time they're spending.
Right. So if you hire an assistant and they're working for you, but you're their only client, most likely they're your employee. However, if they're doing this for multiple businesses and they have a bona fide business and you get their W-9 and they have their own EIN and they look and smell like a business themselves, most of the time it's an independent contractor. And if you get caught paying somebody like an independent contractor and they're actually an employee, the states and the federal government will come back to you wanting all the federal taxes that you would have paid them as an employee plus interest and penalties.
My understanding is that affects payroll tax, it affects their Social Security, whether they're a freelancer or not.
Absolutely, yeah. And I used to do a lot of these audits, and I still do sometimes. So, for example, I had somebody come in and be like, oh, yeah, I'm an independent contractor, except that invoice number 001, invoice number 002, the invoice numbers were in the same order. Mm-hmm. So it proved to me that I was their only client, and I'm like, I can't treat you like that. I have to have you as an employee. It's just safer because then you also have workers' comp issues. If they ever claim unemployment for any reason and they list you, the unemployment company is going to come back and be like, they said that they worked for you, but how can they be an independent contractor? They must have been your employee. So it's a murky area for sure, but the worst case scenario, it's easier to have somebody as an employee versus an independent contractor from a risk and liability perspective. It's harder from a bookkeeping perspective. But there are some great resources out there in payroll processing. I mean, you can use QuickBooks to process payroll. You can use ADP or Paychex. There's some big companies that do all of that for you.
When I was working as an engineer as my day job, I actually worked for a company that just completely outsourced that entire process. Like, absolutely everything payroll and HR related went through this third-party company, and the owners could just focus on running their business.
Exactly.
So, and that was a big company, but, you know, just if you have just one assistant, it's going to be a much easier job.
Yeah.
Okay, so another question, you know, is barter. I know sometimes, you know, people trade, you know, like house cleaning for private lessons or, you know, work as somebody's assistant in exchange for lessons. Does that need to be taken into account in your taxes?
Absolutely. Same with Bitcoin. There was a big debacle about Bitcoin, and now it's been defined as actual currency. Timeshares, time banks, all of that. If you have barter transactions or you're bartering somebody for your business, it is taxable income. You would just include it in your income as part of your tax return. So what I always suggest to people, especially performing artists, if you're going to barter for something of your business. So say you have a student who cleans your space where you teach. That you would include the income, and then you could include the expense. But if you do, I'm going to barter with my hairdresser to do my hair, and then you have income, but then you have no expense. So just keep that in mind.
Gotcha. And how do you record that on your taxes?
Just as income, just like ordinary income, same line and everything.
But should you get, like, you know, a written receipt with every transaction when you do that, or?
I would, absolutely. Not everybody's going to be willing to do that, but yeah, I would document it or have like a contract or some type of written documentation that it happened and that the value of it.
Gotcha. Now, we've talked about, you know, some really complicated and specific stuff here. And if I was listening to this as somebody who was just getting started in business, I would feel kind of overwhelmed. So, you know, if somebody's just getting started, what's that? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was asking you why I didn't hear that.
Okay. So, you know, if somebody's just getting started as a business, what steps can they take to make sure that they set themselves up right?
Don't do it alone. Ask for help. It's totally worth to spend the couple hundred dollars to sit down with somebody than it is to try to go backwards and fix everything. It's so much easier just to do it right up front and never have to worry it again until you want to change your business model. Like I said, there's the Small Business Administration that usually have an office in every state that you can usually sit down and one-on-one with somebody in classes. You also have your local Chamber of Commerce's. You have your local SCORE chapters. You also have the IRS.gov website. They actually have training webinars all the time for small business owners. Those two publications that I recommended from the IRS website, Publication 583 and Publication 463, are very helpful. Your local CPAs, any local CPA, especially if you're going to create a relationship with an accountant or a CPA or an attorney so that you always have a resource if needed. But like I said, the plan, don't let them run and try to get you down an aisle because that's going to cost them money because their hourly rate tend to be a little bit higher. Go in there with specific questions, do as much as you can by yourself, and then have them review it. That will save you a lot of money. Otherwise, if you say, just set it up for me, it's going to cost you a lot more. There's resources everywhere. You know, my door is always open, too, and if you have any questions. And it sounds scarier than what it is, and that's the hard part, is that, you know, I live and breathe this stuff every day, so I can spell out tax code. But the IRS isn't trying to make it overly complicated. What's happened is that people have come back and lobbied, or specific groups have come in and said, well, we want this, well, we want this, and so they include it, and that's why the tax code is so long.
Now, you know, when tax time comes, you know, should you do your taxes by hand or use preparation software or have an accountant prepare them for you?
If you feel comfortable and your situation is not complicated, you can use TurboTax or TaxAct, or there's a whole bunch of them out there. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, definitely ask for help.
And how much does that typically cost? I know it's going to vary, but ballpark.
Yeah, it usually depends on the number of forms. So if you have more than one business, it's going to cost more. It also depends on how good your books are. If you have nice, clean books, it's going to be a lot cheaper. If you give us a shoebox, it's going to be a lot more. So do the best that you can being prepared, and it'll save you a lot of money. Most CPAs, they're probably a simple tax return is $500 and above.
Okay. And is it generally possible to get like a ballpark quote from somebody, or do they really have to look through your stuff and charge you for that before they can tell you how much it's going to be?
Almost everybody can give you a ballpark before they start. And if they can't, don't go there.
All right. Well, I think we better wrap up and move on to taking questions from our listeners. But before we do that, you know, if you can take one thing away from this call, what should it be?
Plan ahead. Plan how you want your business to be set up. Plan how you want your bookkeeping to be. Get it organized in advance, and it will make your life so much easier in the future. All about taking the time to set things up in the front so that, you know, at January 1st, you're not having a complete panic attack.
That's good advice for anything. All right. And if people want to learn more from you, what was that?
I said with taxes, people always try to, like, put it in the back of the mind. So.
And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
I actually have a couple products that I wrote last year because I got so many questions from dancers. And there are some other books out there. The problem is they don't keep them up to date, and they also talk at a very high level instead of kind of starting from the ground up. So I actually, last year, I wrote 3 books for dancers. One is an independent dancer and fitness instructor book on how to start your business, how to set up your business, questions to consider, how to do taxes, and it's an ebook that's available online. There's another one for dance studio owners. So if you want to open a dance studio, it's kind of like the business plan 101 and things to think about before you get started and plan. And it comes with, both of those come with checklists and Excel spreadsheets that you can use for your bookkeeping or for business planning. The third one I did is for dance workshops. If you plan on hosting events or hosting other dancers, that's also another helpful one. And those are all available on instant download from raq-on.net. And if anybody buys one by Monday night at 8 p.m., I'll throw in a second one for free.
Ooh, that is awesome. I've read the workshop hosting one, and I can definitely recommend it. So I know the rest of them are going to be great.
Well, thank you.
And also, if people want to learn from you dance-wise, a really nice choice would be to come to Shimmy-a-thon this year, because I'm teaching there, too. Do you want to tell us about it?
Shimmy-a-thon is so much fun. It's my favorite event of the year. It's a crazy event where we have 8 instructors, and they rotate every hour and a half. They're all different topics. They're all different styles, all different experience levels, and all different backgrounds. So by the end, you have tried Turkish, Egyptian, Lebanese, props, non-props, history and culture. And it's 2 days in March, March 28th and 29th. It's in our new space in White River Junction, Vermont. And we have 2 different tracks so that we keep the workshop small. There's usually 50 spots a year, but between 2 spaces, we were able to keep it so that it's a nice, intimate event.
That's what I love about this, is that it's like got all the variety of a big festival. But, you know, there are master classes that are bigger than 25 people. So you really get to, like, meet people and talk to people and really have a nice time.
Absolutely. We've had people who've come every 5 years and they room with the person that they met last year, and it's wonderful.
Excellent. And I understand there are only a couple spots left. Is that right?
5 spots left.
Okay. So people sign up now. And I assume that's also on rockon.net.
Exactly.
Under events. So, again, that was raq-on.net. Excellent. Well, let's go ahead and open this to questions from our listeners. So if you're on the webcast and you don't have a microphone or a phone connected, you can use a little chat box on the right. To see the chat box, you click on the little button on the right side that looks like a little cartoon talking bubble. If you're on the phone or on Skype, you can press ** to unmute yourself. And that's kind of a self-directed thing, so I don't have to approve you to do that. So on the phone, it's **. If you're on Skype, it would be ** on the Skype keypad, not just on your computer's keyboard. So if you have a question that you'd like to ask, go ahead and type that in or unmute yourself and tell us your name. I suppose you can ask anonymously if you really want to. Okay, I don't see any questions yet. So once more, that's **, or use the chat box on the right. And while we're waiting, Amity, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that I didn't ask you about today?
Let me think about that for a second. We should also probably mention that there are state taxes outside of federal taxes. And a lot of the state forms follow the federal forms, so you kind of fill out your federal forms first, and then the states usually use the federal net income to do their taxation levels. But sometimes you may, if you work in different states, you may have to allocate your income based on whatever state that you earned it in.
That sounds complicated. Okay. So I think we have somebody on the line. Hi there.
Hi, it's Saida.
Hi, Saida. How are you?
Good. I tried to send the questions in chat in Skype, but it doesn't go through. So can I send it now? Can I say it now?
Absolutely. Yes, please.
Yeah. So let's say I live in Massachusetts and I get one performance a year or two in New Hampshire. So do I have to file a state report, a state return for New Hampshire, or is there like an amount that you have to have in order to file another return?
New Hampshire does not have business income taxes unless you make more than $50,000 a year. So that is one thing about New Hampshire.
Okay, I just made an example, but in general, so each state has different minimums, but it's quite looks like a big number, right?
New Hampshire doesn't have quote-unquote an income tax. In fact, it does. It just depends what level of income that you're at. So like New Hampshire, if you're above $50,000, usually there's a form that you have to file for business taxes. Massachusetts.
No, I live in Massachusetts and I get two shows, in a year or two events that I travel to, whatever, Rhode Island or New Hampshire, something. Where do I understand in the federal report it would be the same, but so that income would not get filed if I don't make the minimum, or because I made it there, or you still put it in your home state report?
You still file it at the federal level. But then you would allocate, so say you make $1,000 in the year in total, but you have three different states. At the federal level, you would report the $1,000 to the federal government. And for the states, you would allocate that $1,000 between the three. But one of those three may not have a threshold that you've met, so you wouldn't have to report it to the state at all.
Okay. So even I don't put it in my home, so that part, whatever, it's a small amount or not, but... Okay,
correct.
And that threshold depends on the state, so you have to find guidelines. I mean, I wasn't thinking of situations where you would make any close to what you said for New Hampshire, but are all the states the same or similar, ballpark?
They're all over the map, unfortunately. So, like, the threshold in Massachusetts might be $400. The threshold in Rhode Island could be $800. The one in Vermont could be $1,000. Yeah, you have to go state by state, unfortunately.
So, yeah, if it's like
a 400.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a good
thank
question, Ada. Thank
you.
And it also sounds like maybe the best thing to do in that situation would be to call the Department of Revenue in the state.
Yep, or go on their websites. Most of the websites say it right on the website.
Excellent. That was a great question. If there are any others, go ahead and press ** to unmute yourself, or you can type in the chat box at right. Looks like we might just be at the end here. But we'll give people one more second. I know a lot of folks submitted questions in advance, and those made it into the interview questions. So we don't have as many caller questions as we would ordinarily because we had such good participation early. Okay. Well, then let's call that done. So thank you again, Amity, for coming. That was so helpful.
No, thank you for having me. And thank you for providing this opportunity to have such a neat event.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you also to our sponsor, Alia Babbitt. Don't forget to check out her free webinar, How to Break Out of That Dance Rut, 7 Ways to Spark Inspiration, Refresh Creativity, and Awaken Joy for Real. And if you've listened to Alia's 2 appearances on the Clubhouse, you know she's got a lot to share, so this is going to be worth it. You can get that at aliafabbitt.com/dance-rut. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We have a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members, so I'll send out an email short that will have an invitation to that group. Just be aware that there is an approval delay, so we can keep this limited to dancers. So you have to ask to join the group, and then I have to approve before you post. And the email will also include a link to the call recording, so you can listen to it again for anything that you missed, and a link to Amity's resources. I'll also include a link to a feedback survey, because the Clubhouse is run by me, but it's for all of us. So if you have ideas for topics or speakers or any improvements that I could make to these calls, I'd love to hear them. And our next call is going to be on Saturday, February 21st at noon Eastern time. And my guest, Asala Ibrahim, will be talking about Iraqi Qadiyya. And the last thing I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would enjoy these calls, you can invite them to join us at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.